gens de la charité. Pas même si c'est une patate de gratin.
This is a book about secrets, the things that you wouldn't know about if you weren't born and raised in an old New Orleans family, and most of the people who told you these things weren't dead.
That was local author Rosary O'Neill, PhD, talking about her new nonfiction book, New Orleans Carnival Cruise, The History, Spirit, and Secrets of Mardi Gras. She's my guest today. She's also a playwright, a director, a screenwriter, and a scholar who hails from New Orleans. She was the founding artistic director at Southern Rep Theatre, where her plays about family with Southern Gothic themes were produced for many years. She has extensive experience in acting and theatre production, and she's written the textbook The Actor's Checklist, as well as 22 plays. She's also written a novel about French painter Edgar Degas's connection to New Orleans, as well as a play and a musical based on the same material. The musical will be performed at Bard College later this year. She's also a professor emeritus of drama and speech at Loyola University of New Orleans and a recipient of 5 Fulbright Awards. And she's a member of the Hudson Valley Playwrights Group. This is Between the Lines on WGXC. I'm your host, Anne Forbes Cooper.
Charité, comme un petit jeune pour mec et ton cap ton maillot. Capitaine, capitaine, voyage ton plein, galant c'est l'autre voisin. La charité, pour d'autres ne nous joignent, pour d'autres tous ne nous joignent, ouais, au grand bon que
So, Rosary, welcome to Between the Lines.
I'm so delighted to be here. Thanks.
Now, your book, New Orleans Carnival Cruise, The History, Spirit, and Secrets of Mardi Gras, which came out earlier this year, reveals the traditions, the secret societies, the history, and the evolution of how New Orleans and Mardi Gras came to be as integral to each other as red beans and rice, as emblematic a dish as Louisiana Creole cuisine. So what exactly are carnival crews?
Cruise is just a fancy word for club.
Okay.
Because the carnival cruise came out of a pretentious period in Southern history, like the Ku Klux Klan. I don't want to compare it to that, but they arose about the same time. They out of a need to express one's importance in a destroyed culture. So the carnival crews were private men's clubs that arose primarily after the Civil War as a way for people to be kings and queens and maids in their own courts and honor each other. And now, obviously, they didn't turn into the heinous groups like the Ku Klux Klan, but they did evolve and maintain their secrecy and retain the word carnival cruise, K-R-E-W-E, as opposed to carnival clubs, which we would probably call them today. And in the vernacular, people say, what clubs you're in? What clubs are you in? It means really, what carnival cruise are you in? And of today, of course, there are many more types of cruise, women's clubs, butchers clubs, dog owners crews. I mean, also you name the kind of group that you're in and there may be a carnival crew for it.
Okay, now just describe a little bit about the contents of this book. So it's very comprehensive.
This is a book about secrets, the things that you wouldn't know about if you weren't born and raised in an old New Orleans family, and most of the people who told you these things weren't dead. Because when I originally did this exploration, I was a graduate student at UCLA, and at a very bohemian time when people wanted to expose what were the roots or the hidden parts of our society. My family, my father particularly, was involved in 7 different carnival crews, and because of his support, I was able to get into the secret files of one such group and discover how these men's clubs really work to applaud each other and to exclude people that they didn't like.
New Orleans is practically synonymous with Mardi Gras. And New Orleans is a pretty small city, 370,000 people or thereabouts.
It's tiny.
It's tiny. And most, you say, are involved with Mardi Gras. So it's obviously a huge business.
It's hard to conceive of how big a business it is. It's just that it lives year-round. For example, I just got back yesterday from Paris, and in the refrigerator, my husband had waiting for me red beans and rice that he had to go to Popeye's in Kingston to get so that I would have it as soon as I came home. So there's red beans and rice, for example, which is a Mardi Gras dish. Every restaurant in New Orleans on Monday has red beans and rice. You cannot go and not order that traditional dish. And so the spirit of entertainment goes throughout the year. And of course, New Orleans has over 15 million people visiting it every year. So that even though it's a tiny little city, it's a city that has many tendrils into many places, many countries. For instance, in February, I'll do the keynote speech at a conference at the University of Cologne in Germany about the secret societies of New Orleans. Yeah.
Now, you are, as you said, a native New Orleanian. New Orleanian? New Orlean? How do you pronounce that?
We say New Orleanian. Uh-huh. But, you know, I'm having a hard time saying it, but people say New Orleans, they say New Orleans, they say New Orleans. There are a lot of different pronunciations, depending upon what even part of the city you're from.
Your family has been there for many generations, I understand. Just give us a little bit of background.
Well, I love to drive by the cemetery in New Orleans because there's so many relatives there, becoming more and more than here. I mean, because of the fact New Orleans is the city the farthest south, and that the Civil War didn't destroy the city, there are a lot of old family tombs there, and you can see the history of a lot of people just in the people who died. And they're beautiful tombs above the ground with winged angels and widows in stone knocking on closed doors and all this sort of mythology. So, yes, my family goes back for many, many generations in New Orleans, and it still breaks my heart that I don't live there. Just breaks my heart, yeah.
You live in Rhine Cliff now, but you were born and raised in New Orleans, right?
Yes, I was born and raised in New Orleans. And there's something about New Orleans, I find it similar in New York. When you leave New York, people look at you with, like, I'm talking about New York City, with horror. Like, what happened to you? Did you go mad that you're living in New York City? Well, New Orleans is a tiny little town, but people kind of feel the same way. Like, if you left, you must be a lunatic. Why would you? And part of the reason for that is that people have stayed there for many, many generations, and it's so darn much fun to live there. I mean, there is always a party. When I lived in New Orleans, we had 2 big garbage cans in the attic full of decorations. And literally every month we went from Mardi Gras to St. Patrick's Day to Mother's Day to Valentine's Day. I mean, there was always some excuse to celebrate. And given that life has a lot of pain, it's nice that we add in the sugar to it. You know, put a little sugar in your coffee. And that's what makes New Orleans so fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because the one of the many things I got from reading this book, and I loved reading it, was that I really just wanted to go there soon. I mean, I have been to New Orleans, but very briefly. I was just a couple of days there, and I've never been there during Mardi Gras. But you have such a sense of the what it's like. I mean, there's so much color in this book because you cover everything. You cover oral histories, you cover the politics, you cover the costumes in great detail, as well as the social strata of the crews. The one thing that puzzled me throughout the book, actually, was why are they so secretive?
Why are they so? Well, there's a certain amount of glamour in that, isn't there? I mean, if you can be a part of a group that excludes other people, but kind of let people know in a sly way that you're a member of that, there can be a lot of fun. Well, there's fun in it, for one thing. And two, there's a lot of glamour in it. You know, you can invite your friends there. And afterwards, for example, most of these carnival balls have supper dances in which the men are no longer masked. They're in full dress. So, you know, you can go to the dance afterwards and find out all these fun people who invite you to the party, so to speak. So it has it's interesting. Why do any of us like Halloween? Yeah, what is it about that sense of being able to be two people?
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. The mystery and the potential for something unknown coming into your life, I think.
I think that's very much it. And of course, you know, at the carnival ball, there all these sort of things where after each dance, a man is supposed to give the woman he's dancing with a favor, which is a wrapped gift. And you know, there are all these stories about how the man gave the woman the wrong wrapped gift, who's going to engage one girl, but gave the gift to the wrong person, or the mistress was danced with, exposed to the wife. I mean, it makes for a lot of fun stories, let's put it that way. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I also found fascinating how it grew up, the origins of carnival. And you say New Orleans attracted the rich and the dreamers, from French aristocrats to Spanish conquerors to American entrepreneurs, along with their indentured servants and slaves. Each group created its own aristocracy, and as the cultures melded, so did their love of theatre, balls, and extravagant celebrations.
I have never lived in a town where women had more ball gowns in my life. My mother had an attic room built just for her ball gowns. She must have had at least 40. Because, you see, in carnival, it's not just one dance. Beginning with December the 12th, no, actually it's January 6th, 6 days after the beginning of the year, there's literally a ball every night. So if you're very active in this thing, it's not unusual that you would need at least 10 or 15 new ball gowns. So women change their dresses. There are even shops in New Orleans that they have a list of who they sew what dress to, so they can be sure that two women in the same organization wouldn't be sitting next to each other in the same ball gown. I mean, it's a complex town that loves glamour. And it really, it pays for glamour. They said there are more ball gowns sold in New Orleans than in any other city in America for this tiny little city. And the same thing for tuxedos. I mean, the boys start in their high schools or even in the eighth grade to wear tuxedos to parties and then full dress. You go to other places, they don't even know what these things are. And young men in Louisiana are sort of raised on this ritual of penguin presenting themselves in an interesting way. Now, whether or not that will, how long that will survive into the future, I don't know. But for now, it seems to be doing pretty well.
Okay, and we're just going to take a quick break. We are here with Rosary O'Neill.
The one and only Aaron Neville, ladies and gentlemen. We're gonna go down to New Orleans on this. Take you to the place that American music was born, a place called Congo Square.
Thank you. closing that night, I could not turn away. They had that motor in motion, and I seen them dancing and prancing with that snake.
And you are listening to Between the Lines, and we are back with Rosary O'Neill, who is talking about her book, New Orleans Carnival Cruise, The History, Spirit and Secrets of Mardi Gras. Now, just before the break, you were saying about you were never able
you
to
never
leave,
New Orleans without feeling you've betrayed it. It's like betraying your best friend, because you almost feel like when you're raised there and born there that you have an obligation to stay there because you've had so much enjoyment. I had so much family there. It was like a village. I mean, I literally had my grandmother 7 blocks away, my brother another 7 blocks, my sister 3 blocks, my aunt. I mean, there's a whole nucleus of people that stay there and that somehow engender this philosophy of love for family, which I have not really seen anywhere else except maybe in Europe and maybe a bit in New York, because people, again, in New York City, if you're lucky enough to be born in this area, somehow stay here, yeah.
We touched on earlier very briefly about your family, and I think you're being very modest here, because you, in fact, were born into the kind of what might be called, what, the upper classes of New Orleans?
I was born rich. Someone told me that recently and said, Rosary, you were born rich. And I was like, oh, no, was I? Yes, I was born rich, but that doesn't mean I stayed rich. But yes, I had the privilege of being born into wealth. And being raised in a house where there was a cook and a maid and a nurse and a chauffeur, I mean, things we can't even imagine except in movies today, was sort of a part of that culture. And so there was this idea that if you had certain things, then you should create enjoyment. And unfortunately, the onus really went to women, that our task was to entertain and to be the entertainment, so to speak. And so the whole Mardi Gras thing creates a context for that kind of celebration. Mm-hmm.
And your father was a chief lieutenant or no, sorry?
My father was an attorney, but in these carnival organizations, there are different strata, and there's something called a captain, which is the man who sort of runs the organization, and like a king. And then there are lieutenants, which are the men that are slightly below this person. Could be anywhere from 6 to maybe 15 or 20 of these men who sort of run the organization. For things as simple as putting name tags on seats to the order of presentation of debutantes to ordering the food that's going to be served the day of rehearsal. I mean, I think I became a writer and a theater director because I was so flabbergasted by the glamour of the whole thing. I mean, people spend a lot of money for one night at a ball, and what they're doing basically is spending anywhere from, the club spends anywhere from $200,000 to maybe $2 million on basically a party. Mm-hmm. Where people dress glamorously, and there's a whole ritual of a king and a queen, maids at court that are presented, and some sort of a little skit or dance. I was so surprised when I got old and realized I couldn't actually be in this unless I married a man in it who somehow was involved. So it required, for a woman, quite a bit of engineering to get involved in this, and then, of course, at a secondary status. Mm-hmm.
Right. Tell me a bit about your research methods. I mean, this book was lovingly and exhaustively researched.
5 years. Actually, 6. And basically, of course, having lived in New Orleans and having been presented in 5 different balls, my sister as well, I actually had the inside experience of being a young woman that was presented in these balls, walking around a circle of men in sort of pajama-like costumes, applauding, hoping I was pretty enough to be applauded more than the girl before me. I mean, it was such superficiality. You can't even believe this is yourself. So I went through that experience, and then I wanted to write just a historical book about how pretty it all was, but when I was at UCLA, they said, oh, no, you have to do a social profile. You have to do a complete expose of how this happens, because, you know, that was California Bohemians. So then I was able to get to use no one's name, but get the secret files of one particular organization. By that I mean all the paperwork it had on how it was structured and created for about 50 years. So I was able to figure out all the different things that go on, such as, you know, something there's something called an in-between person. An in-between person is basically you have to submit a list of invitations of people you want. And if there's anybody questionable on that list, for example, we don't like the location of where they live, that's questionable. We don't like the sound of their name, that's questionable. Do they have an accent, et cetera. Only certain accents are acceptable. Then there's an in-between person who's designated to contact you. And so you never really know anybody. You just have this person that goes back and forth. Well, that was very interesting to me to know there was such a thing as an in-between group. I didn't know that. So the book deals with how these organizations run, effectively or not, based on a hidden structure that only members kind of know. A little bit like a fraternity, I would imagine, except putting on a very big public event. Yeah.
I also just want to emphasize the point a little bit that these crews were mainly men, and it was must have been quite a feat for you as a woman to infiltrate their kind of inner core and get all this information from them.
That's an interesting point. Well, I never meant to write anything that was harmful because I love Carnival myself. So, but I guess that it showed a kind of, I think New Orleans is evolving. I really do think that New Orleans is evolving, especially since Katrina. There is a much more inclusive attitude toward women and people of color and people of different nationalities. Yeah. So, yeah, that it didn't require a lot of finagling. I mean, most people, because of the fact I said this will be used anonymously, you're going to be Mr. N, or you're going to be the father of debutante Z. Most people would pretty much, you know, tell you what they have experienced. Yeah.
You mentioned Hurricane Katrina. So what has been the impact long term, I guess, or short term?
Well, long term, I feel New Orleans is a better place. You know, I have, as you know, a place in the French Quarter still down there. And one, there are fewer people, so it's less congested. And two, the people down there stand up for themselves more than they used to. For example, it used to be in the French Quarter, there was so many tourists, you could not walk down the street for the horrible garbage and smells. Well, after Katrina, they cleaned everything up, and it was like perfume smells. Everything's clean all the time. And then the city officials wanted to take away the cleaning squad, and the people of New Orleans marched on City Hall and said, you're not going to have it be dirty again like it was before. So the New Orleans French Quarter is pristine, like completely different than it was before. But partly because of Katrina, partly because the people in New Orleans just are not going to take it anymore. If they want something, they're going to go for it. And that's pretty amazing. The Saints has helped tremendously, too. There's a great sense of community because of that.
When you were doing research for this book, was it obvious the kind of book that you were going to do, or did it evolve and sort of reveal itself to you through the process?
Well, I mean, it was a discovery for me, too, being a woman, not being a part of these things. And I think many people actually, they're active, non-active, and inactive. I mean, many people in the organizations are just go to the dance. They don't know anything about how the place is run. So it was a curious thing for me to figure out how these different organizations ran, and I didn't know much about it till I started exploring it.
Okay, and we're just going to take a quick break. I'm here. I'm Anne Forbes Cooper. You're listening to Between the Lines. I'm here with Rosary O'Neill, PhD. She is an author, playwright, and actor. And next up, we're going to be talking about the Actress Checklist, another one of her many books.
Thank you.
I went down to St. James Infirmary. Saw my baby there. She was stretched out on a long white table, so cold, so sweet, so fair. Let her go, let her go. God bless her. Wherever she may be, she can look this wide world over, but she'll never find a sweet man like me.
Bragging.
When I die, bury me in straight lace shoes. I want a box back coat and a Stetson hat.
John B., that is.
Put a $20 gold piece on my watch chain so the boys will know that I died standing back.
And you are listening to Between the Lines. I'm Anne Forbes Cooper, and I'm here with Rosary O'Neill, who is talking about her book, New Orleans Carnival Cruise, The History, Spirit, and Secrets of Mardi Gras.
Well, I never expected this book to be published. And I think when you write in a way that you're not expecting it to be read, you can be a little bit braver than when you think, oh, lots of people are going to be listening to this. And so it was written originally as a PhD dissertation, and it was filed away. And then when I was in New Orleans and I founded, I was a college professor at Loyola University and founded a professional theater company. Actually, people, a couple of publishers came to me and wanted to publish the book. And I said, no, horrors. I didn't want to live in this town and have this book come out. I just could see all these enemies coming at me. I thought, I don't really want this to be published. Then after I moved up east and after Katrina and after everything sort of changed in New Orleans and after a different last name, I thought, well, okay, I can publish it now. It's almost like living past your death, you know? Yeah.
Living past your death. Okay, so having done that, having lived past your death, what's been the reaction?
Well, the reaction of the book has been really pretty wonderful. You know, I haven't had to hide or flee. People have found it interesting, and I just think New Orleans is a much more receptive place post-Katrina, yeah. The reaction's so far been pretty good, yeah, because, you know, we don't know who's around the corner, but yeah, people have been very interested to find out how everything runs. And of course, a lot of the old ways have changed simply because the municipal auditorium, which was a building that was constructed to house these carnival balls, I mean, in the downtown part of New Orleans, was destroyed. I mean, and there had been a whole bureaucracy there of who got the dates closest to Mardi Gras, who got the biggest side of the auditorium, what entrance you went in. There was a whole strata of, like, it was a castle and who was going to get into the castle. Well, that's been knocked out. It's not come back, so that all of the different organizations are having to start a new in a hotel or a different lieu. And that immediately has kind of blown a lot of the seams out of Mardi Gras.
Now, you've written several other books, and you've also written 22 plays.
Right.
Published by Samuel French.
Right.
You've written a book called The Actress Checklist.
Right.
When was that published? When did that come out?
The first came, you know, it's like, you don't want to say the ages of your children because it dates you. Now you don't want to say the ages of your books because, like, what, did she write that when she was 10? Okay, no, the Actress Checklist came out in 1992, and it just came out in the fourth edition in 2013.
Mm-hmm. And it is to a textbook of sorts.
Well, you know, it's billed as a text and trade book in that it's hopefully for both markets. But yes, it's used at a lot of high schools and many, many colleges across the country.
Because what it does, it really sort of takes you through approach how to approach a scene. Right. It gives you lots of for examples, and then it kind of gives you a real sort of insight into the actor's process.
I hope so. I started to write this book because I was teaching beginning acting over and over at Loyola University. I did for 18 years, and I got sick of saying the same thing over and over again. And I created the question of how can I get a beginning person who's never seen much professional theater, has only seen television maybe, how can I get them to really be a great actor, to move forth as quickly as possible? So I interviewed theaters and training programs across America and Europe and tried to come up with a nugget in each chapter of what are the things you have to know in order to move forward really fast and well in a scene. Because actors work all the time with different people. You cannot bring in, I mean, you're not working in the same school, the same theater. Most times in movies or in plays, you're working with a completely different group of people. So what are the basic things that you would want to know to move forward? And I found that was very helpful. For example, there's a chapter on place. Okay, how do I set up the stage space so it's the most evocative for me to get into this character and the most revealing for the audience? How do I do that? What are some of the areas that I should consider? Well, you know, that's great. So that's why it's called the checklist. So, you know, yeah. Well, you say, oh, well, the designer is going to pick out the space. Well, that's true. But let's say you're walking into a stage and it's a funeral scene. What is the feeling in the room, in this room, as opposed to feeling at a wedding reception? Is there any kind of tangible thing I could notice that's different? That's the kind of question you ask.
Yeah, well, in a way, I'm your target audience because I've done, you know, some acting. I haven't done a huge amount, but I'm hoping to do more. So I'm going to be standing there with that book in hand. And it made me think in a completely different way about what I was trying to do as an actor.
Yeah, because you see, it's wonderful that you're an actress because it's the bravest profession in the world to get up in front of a bunch of unknown people, now millions of people on screen, and bare your soul. You don't want to do it unless you can be great. It's just too humiliating to get up there and be average at it. So whatever you can do to forward yourself, it's a solitary journey, like a writer. As you said, so much of your work is done with no one even seeing that you're doing it, you know?
Yeah.
The audience senses it, though, somehow. You know, we sense the intelligence, the thoughtfulness of a great actor. We can feel that, too. We don't know what it is. We just know this person, Derek Jacobi, is better than Tom Smith. But you, as you work as an actor, you know that it's the multiple thoughts that you have in your head from all the different work that you've done that gives you what we call weight on stage. You see, someone is light, it means they're thin, there's nothing going on in their head and their body. When they have weight, it's because they have thought through, acted through, and they have deep emotions and thoughts going on. It doesn't mean they're bawling, it just means that they're totally there and present.
How much acting have you done yourself?
Listen, I wanted to leave the profession of acting. I found that such a painful profession. But I'm acting all the time because what happens is once you become a teacher, you're acting. And once you become a professional writer, you're always acting. They make you read your play scripts. You have to get up and perform. So in a way, we're always acting. And yes, I don't act in plays that are of mine other than reading parts, etc. But yes, we're acting, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So is that your main passion, the theater?
No. My main passion is travel. I love to travel. Okay. It's not my main passion, the theater. Well, I think it's all theater. Don't you think so? Writing, I'm writing a novel right now, and I just finished a first draft of a play in Paris on Marie Laveau. I like them all because it's a way of thinking.
Yeah. You like all your children, right?
I like all my babies.
Now, I have to ask you about a book that I just read very briefly about that I found fascinating, and it's about Degas, yeah, who went to New Orleans. Well, you describe it.
Well, I've written a novel on Degas and actually a play, Degas in New Orleans, which is going to be done in Oregon in 1 week at the Ashland Shakespeare Festival. So glad you mentioned that. Oh, wow. And I was just in Paris because in 2017 is the centennial of the death of Edgar Degas, and much is going on with, and hopefully I'll be part of it, with the centennial, celebrating that at various museums and American centers in Paris. The thing that's wonderful is that Degas' mother was from New Orleans.
Which I did not know. And when I read some of the things he got up to in the plot. Now, is this a nonfiction or a fiction book?
Well, we call it a historical play, but it's really rooted in Degas' life. I did about 5 years of research on various fellowships, and I lived periodically in the house where he lived in New Orleans. So I read all of his letters at the Tulane Library. So it's rooted in, you know, it's rooted in the real experience of Degas in New Orleans, which was scandalous. Yay!
Do scandal. Tell.
We love nasty. Well, do tell. Well, he and his two brothers had gone over to New Orleans to save the cotton business of his uncle. And, you know, you see that famous painting with the cotton office. It's actually his uncle's cotton office that's gone bankrupt, and all his relatives sitting around this bad cotton trying to figure out what to do. When Edgar went there, not only his brother was married to his first cousin, she was going blind. His brother was having an affair with the mistress who, or her next door neighbor, who was reading to her his blind wife. The blind wife was pregnant. Edgar Degas fell in love with her. In his efforts to help save this family from drowning in the lapsed cotton business, they went through all the money of his father's two banks. His father was a banker in Paris and Naples. His father was thrown into prison and actually died in the prison. It only could happen in real life. You wrote this in a play, people would think, oh, you're stretching for melodrama. They would say you're pushing melodrama. Well, the melodrama was the life. Eventually, Edgar Degas' brother abandoned his wife and five children with his mistress, brought her back to Paris. And people in Louisiana were so upset that they all changed the name, their last names, from Degas to Musson, the mother's maiden name, which was a custom. If you were betrayed by your husband, you took back the name of your father. So for literally almost 85 years, no one knew that Degas has like 30 nieces and nephews, great nieces and nephews now in New Orleans, because everyone had gone back to the mother's maiden name. Yeah. Until about 15 years ago, there was a tombstone with the name Degas, D-E-G-A-S, on it, which was one of the babies that had died right after childbirth, which led to the clue to find out there were so many of his descendants actually in Louisiana. So yeah, this is a story about a family that failed, but how that experience birthed Edgar Degas as a wonderful impressionist, because he went back to Paris and started the School of Impressionism, rooted in the agony that he experienced in trying to save his family after the Civil War. A little bit like how it is today. You know?
Well, it's a fascinating story. Now, just... I'm not clear. Is it? It's a play as well as an.
Well, I wrote it as a play, and it's published by Samuel French, and it's actually a musical version of the play. Is actually going to be done here at Bard College.
Oh my goodness! What a coincidence! Just up the road.
We'll be working at Bard College. Yes, it so happens that December 17th and 18th there will be a musical, the musical Degas in New Orleans, based on the play Degas in New Orleans, that will be performed at the college for 2 days. Yeah. So it'll be done twice within the next 2 months. Yeah, so hopefully.
How exciting. Okay, and you are listening to Between the Lines. I'm your host, Anne Forbes Cooper. I'm here with Rosary O'Neill, the multi-talented and extremely productive and prodigious writer, author, playwright, and actor. And we'll be right back.
Sure enough, hear you calling. Feel that gentle rain be falling.
see where you at, my darling. And I know you might grow. You want a second life from Garden District down to that lower nine. Legion fears till they find your train. You know it's strange, but some things remain the same. We're all down on that Mississippi. Called Sweet Home New Orleans. I love to hear you calling and feel the gentle rain be falling. I love to hear where you at, my little darling.
And you're listening to Between the Lines. I'm your host, Anne Forbes Cooper. I'm here with Rosary O'Neill. Now, you also teach a workshop at Omega, right?
I'll be teaching a workshop at Omega in June of this year, writing a monologue, Leaving Your Legacy. And we'll talk about how to write in the first person, the most cogent parts of your life, and leave a legacy for people you want to, either in your family or in the world, yeah. So I'll be teaching there in June. Mm-hmm.
How does that differ from writing memoirs?
Hopefully they're both good.
quality.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, as an actress, a monologue, it has to kind of zip on the tongue. When we say, well, I want a good monologue, you mean I want to get up there for 2 minutes and have people mesmerized by what I'm saying. I think in a memoir, you can have a little more latitude. You may be able to get away from the core a little bit more than in a monologue. It's a tighter structure.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So it's a monologue for public performance.
Right, for public performance. And I really think that if you can read something out loud, it probably has a little bit more thrum to it than if it falls flat. One of the main things I do when I write is I read things out loud. And like sometimes I read a page out loud and everything will die except one sentence. And I say, can it be that bad that I want to cut 3/4 of this page? Yes! Cut it. Yeah.
Okay, I think I have to take this workshop because I've been struggling with monologues and... I haven't quite discovered how to make them zing, how to make them sing, or even what the purpose of a monologue is in a way. So that's kind of interesting. Now I'm going to move on to yet another of your projects, which is the TV series called Heirs, which is about a royal family in New Orleans.
Actually, the title is now, working title is New Orleans, which is about an upper-class family, something like the Carnival Balls, but living in peril on the edge of financial and emotional disaster. So it kind of takes you inside those Gothic mansions on the Gulf of Mexico, and it revolves primarily around money, which, because as we know, is the root of all sex and the root of all evil. We know that. So we don't have to say they're separate, but basically the father of the family has died, and there are 5 potential heirs, and the story revolves around which one of these people is going to get the money. And they're all artists of one sort or another, because that's what I like to write about. I mean, there's a son who's a wonderful painter, but his works are not doing well in the French Quarter. There's a daughter who's studying for a PhD in poetry because she likes to read poetry. She can't write it. She wants to, but she can't. There's a real estate son who invests in art and is hoping to make money off that. So there's that model stepdaughter who sells her hands in Hollywood because they're so beautiful. I mean, we go on and on and on. So that's the story about my family. As my sister said, the only way mother would ever like it is if it made $1 million.
So you finished this. You're shopping it around.
I've written 12 episodes, and I have a manager who agent who's shopping it in Hollywood. So hopefully, and next time we see each other, we'll have a deal. My TV series is deeply rooted in my family. It's like me saying to you, well, you know, isn't there another story about someone sort of lived on the street where you live? Yeah, there is, but only you lived in that house at that time. So, yeah, it's about really my life experiences.
You mentioned travels. You do a lot of traveling. You said you just come back from Paris.
I had a fellowship to a theater there, the Cartoucherie Theater, to work with the artistic director, and just wrote a play, the first long draft of a play about Marie Laveau, the voodoo queen after death. And basically extended a 20-minute play of mine into a full-length play, which you will see Thursday night at the Hudson Valley Playwrights. The first 10 pages, you'll say, oh, Rose, we talked about that. So I was working on that play. And then also on this Degas Centennial of doing my play and the musical and having the novel published for that in 2017. Yeah. Wow. So those two things. Mm-hmm.
You do so many things. How do you have time to also be involved with the Hudson Valley Playwrights as well?
Well, I everything I do is around the same thing.
Right.
You know, I don't also ride horses and jump from planes. I mean, basically, I'm a hermit. I write all day long, and what I just wrote in Paris, I will gratefully be able to hear read by actors Thursday night. It's so important to hear your work read. I'm so thrilled to have this group here. Yeah. Because, you know, it's not the same when you just do it to yourself, you know. So
Yeah, I agree. It's kind of like a creative fulcrum. You can come and just workshop your whatever it is you're working on. Yes, it's very exciting. I'm looking forward to hearing your play. So just to sort of sum up, what do we have coming up?
Well, what we have coming up in the Rhinebeck area is December 17th and 18th at Bard College will be my musical, Degas in New Orleans, which the music is going to be done by David Temple. Some of you probably know him because he's a brilliant classical guitarist and has done quite a few things at the Performing Arts Society here. And last year, composed the music for my musical Broadway A Bust, which was done also at Bard College. So that's the big event coming up here in December. If you happen to be in Oregon next week, there'll be a reading of the stage play, Dig Out New Orleans. And if you happen to be at the Hudson Valley Playwrights Thursday night in Rhinecliffe, you'll be able to hear the first part of Marie Laveau.
And then you also have the workshop at Omega?
Oh, I've got a workshop at Omega coming up in June, writing your monologue, leaving your legacy. February, I'll be in Germany doing a keynote address. In November, I'll be in New Orleans doing a book signing at the Faulkner Festival.
And do you go down there for Mardi Gras?
I'll be down there for Mardi Gras again this year, y'all.
I'll have to try and find a way to come and join you sometime.
Yeah, it'll be great. Yeah.
Okay. Rosary O'Neill, I want to thank you so much for being on the show. It's been a thrill for me to have you here. And one last question. How can people find you? Just Google your name and look and go to your website.
And I also want to plug Deborah Temple, who is with Red Hook High School, who's directing the production at Bard. I have a website called, and in French it's called Site, Le Site, RosaryO'Neill.com, RosaryO'Neill.com. If you go on that, it will show you all the different events that will be coming up and the different books, and I'd just be honored to have you look at any of them. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
And the playlist for today's show. First, we had the Balfour Brothers, La Danse des Mardi Gras. Then we had the Neville Brothers in Congo Square. Then Louis Armstrong and St. James Infirmary. We had Dr. John's Sweet Home New Orleans. And then taking us out will be Steve Earle's This City. And one last note. While we're on the theme of New Orleans, here's a couple of quotes from what is considered one of the best novels ever written about the city. It's A Confederacy of Dunces by John Kennedy Toole. The only excursion of my life outside of New Orleans took me through the vortex to the whirlpool of despair, Baton Rouge. New Orleans is, on the other hand, a comfortable metropolis which has a certain apathy and stagnation which I find inoffensive. And the second quote is, "At last I crossed Canal Street, pretending to ignore the attention paid me by all whom I passed. The narrow streets of the quarter awaited me. A vagrant petitioned for a hot dog. I waved him away and strode forth. Unfortunately, my feet could not keep pace with my soul. Below my ankles, the tissues were crying for rest and comfort. So I placed the wagon at the curb and seated myself. The balconies of the old buildings hung over my head like dark branches in an allegorical forest of evil. Symbolically, a desire bus hurtled past me, its diesel exhaust almost strangling me." Once again, that was a couple of excerpts from A Confederacy of Dunces by John Kennedy Toole. You've been listening to Between the Lines on WJXE at 90.7 FM. I'm Anne Forbes Cooper. I'll be back next month on the third Thursday at 2 p.m. Signing off.
This city don't wash away. This city won't ever drown. Blood and water and hell to pay. Sky tear open and pain rain down. The medics come with me. I ever won't leave this town. This city won't wash away. This city won't ever drown. Ain't the river or the wind to blame. It's everybody around here knows. Nothing holding back bunch of trains. Simple prayer and a promise is ghost. We just count digging our graves and silent marble above the ground. Maybe our bones will wash away, but this city won't ever drown. just as long as the heart be strong. Like a second line stepping high, reason hill is rolling along. Chantilly to Lucre, Lord, now in Central City uptown, singing Giacomo Pinani, this city won't ever drown. Doesn't matter, cause there ain't no way I'm ever gonna leave this town. This city won't wash away, this city won't ever drown.